This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A North Carolina native is making history as the first male president of the American Nurses Association. Ernest Grant grew up in the small community of Swannanoa in Buncombe County, wanted to be a doctor but couldn't afford medical school. The guidance counselor suggested he become a nurse to earn enough money to pay his tuition and then work his way through school. Well, just 6 months into nursing school, he realizes that he has found his passion. He pursued a Ph.D. in nursing from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Ernest worked for decades at the North Carolina J.C. Burns Center at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He retired in November. Today, he's advocating for the nation's 4 million registered nurses as president of the American Nurses Association. Ernest Grant, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have
you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us about growing up in Swannanoa.
Growing up in Swannanoa was a wonderful thing. I realized that the people there in the community really looked after each other. My mother worked at the post office, and she knew everyone, and everyone knew her. Everyone knew her kids. And so, as I generally tell people, it was almost like you've heard the term, it takes a village. It really did take a village because, if my brothers and sisters did any wrong, and notice I said brothers and sisters because I was a perfect kid. But, you'd always get the eye of, people in the community, would your mother approve of that or, mm-hmm. Things of that sort.
So you had six brothers and sisters,
yes.
Right? You're one of seven kids.
Yes.
So, and you talked about your mother being working for the post office, mm-hmm. got to know everybody. I mean, mm-hmm. felt like also she had school covered, didn't have to show up at a lot of PTA meetings because after all, she knew everybody.
Right. She knew everyone. And then, until we integrated the schools, the teachers that were there, they were also at the same church that we went to. So she almost got a weekly update, if you will, from how we were doing.
Talked about integrating the schools. How large is the Black community or communities in Swannanoa?
It's a fairly small community. I'd say probably, from what I can remember growing up at that time, maybe 300, maybe 500 individuals. It's probably still about that today.
They say close-knit at first mm-hmm. through the schools, but always through the churches, and that was mm-hmm. especially important for you, the church.
Yes, the church played a very central role in my life and still does today.
Talk about that, because you actually worked around the church, and again, this is where this community set its eyes on you, and you didn't mm-hmm. even realize it, but they realized mm-hmm. that you were going places.
We were always the first at church, first ones to
arrive,
first to arrive, last to leave. Yeah. Seriously, the church did play a very big prominent role, and that it was a place where you found community, and you saw the things that people who were members of the church did to band together to help one another out.
Yeah, I think that was it. The thing that you talked about was the mutual support. The one thing they did was help each other.
Correct. We're all poor, but you didn't realize it because everybody was in the same situation. So you planted a big garden, you shared your crop, you picked the fruits that were growing and shared those with your neighbors as well. And everything was, was pretty good.
Growing up in that area and through the church, when did you start developing an idea for how you were going to apply yourself?
I think it started with there were several nurses that attended church, the same church that I did. And, being a little kid, you always wanted to be around adults and hearing adult conversation. So sometimes I would hear them talk about, their week at work or patients that they cared for. At that time, most of them worked at the Black Mountain Sanatorium, which was a specialty hospital for patients who had tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And so it just piqued my interest, the things that they would describe or, what had happened or how they would, provide assistance for people during that week. And I also saw those same nurses, going out in the community and helping, the shut-ins and, either cleaning their house or cooking a meal or just visiting them to make sure that they were okay and, that their health and everything else was held up.
That's interesting because it speaks to the importance of them sort of living in the community. This mm-hmm. is not just a profession that you're hearing about. Mm-hmm. You're actually watching people live their lives and seeing these two things very closely integrated, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And it's something hopefully we'll be able to talk about a little bit later on in the program is sort of the addressing what we're now calling the social determinants of health, things that we as nurses can do within the community to help reduce those stumbling blocks, if you will, that contributes to, a person's illness or, their ability to have and maintain good health.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting to think about it because there is more and more research now being done on those social determinants. And then as we, develop the research, we can figure out ways to manage it. But, your suggestion is that there were people who figured that out because they were parts of that community and just mm-hmm. applied themselves to the community.
I believe so. I think it's just combination of that, combination of, the perhaps following the biblical saying of taking care of your fellow man, those things there. Or I think they all were interwoven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You meanwhile are so you're thinking about this as a medical career one way or another. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking about ways to make money. You were cutting lawns and got to know a lot of people that way, too.
Yes, I did. I made my living, several summers by mowing lawns, mostly for a lot of my teachers that I had. And so it was a very interesting and, fascinating way to, again, get to know people within the community, not only on the African-American side of the community, but also on the white side of the community as well. And being able to, take those resources that, the money that I was earning, putting that into a savings account with the hope of, either buying, something I had an eye for, such as a bicycle mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. or clothes or, things of that sort.
So we're going to talk more about your career as a burn nurse mm-hmm. At the UNC JC Center, for mm-hmm. the burn center there. But your first encounter with medicine was not a good one, and this had to do with your lawn cutting service.
Yes, it did. I was probably in the seventh or eighth grade and was mowing the grass for one of my teachers, and this is when early fall, the leaves were beginning to fall, and had mowed the grass and had raked all the leaves into a pile and was going to go mow yet another lawn. Mm-hmm. And of course, back then, one of the best ways to get rid of the leaves was to burn them. So I set the leaves on fire, but to me, the fire wasn't burning fast enough. So I grabbed the gas can and threw some gas onto the leaves. Something I would not advocate for people to do. And the next thing I knew, there's this big bush, and the bottom branches of one of the trees was, the leaves were sizzling down, and I woke up with singed eyebrows and everything else. So there, but by the grace of God, yeah. that, I possibly could have been a person who has sustained a burn injury.
Yeah, and I'm sure you have scolded people for a lot less than your career, but you made it through that. Mm-hmm. And again, this idea of getting into medical school, doctor, when did you first decide, this is it, I'm going to be a doctor?
I think during starting with middle school through high school, I was always very fascinated with science, yeah. and also fascinated with, just with healthcare in general. Maybe it was because of, the TV shows that were on, right. During that time that, just sort of, got you to, to thinking about that. And just always wanted to, to be a doctor. Actually, my dream, as I tell people, was to be an anesthesiologist and drive a lime green 1968 Cougar with a red interior.
Where did the Cougar part come into this?
That's a cool car.
I suppose you would, and it kind of waving the stethoscope in the wind.
Yes.
I can see it now. So you get to a certain point, a guidance counselor then sort of pulls you aside because you realize med school is going to cost some money, right?
Yes, absolutely. I remember having that conversation with my guidance counselor, and he said, your grades are good enough, but it is going to take a lot of money. Mm. There's not enough, perhaps scholarships that may be available for you. And he said, well, here's a roundabout way if you really wanted to, go ahead and become a physician. Here's a roundabout way to do that, and that is to consider nursing school. And so you could go to at that time what is now Ashelbuckum Technical Community College was called Ashelbuckum Technical Institute. That tells you how long ago that okay. was. But he suggested going there and becoming an RN. And then if I still wanted to do anesthesia, I could become a nurse anesthetist and then work my way through med school that way as a way of having to offset the cost of medical school. And then he said, well, you may not like nursing, so they have this one-year program where you could become a LPN or a licensed practical nurse. And you could do that. It may mean just going to school an extra year, but it's it's a good way to determine whether or not if you would like nursing. And so I took that route, and as you stated in the intro, 6 months into my nursing program, I forgot all about medical school and realized that nursing was my calling.
I want to find out exactly why and what it was that made you see that nursing was actually your passion and not becoming an MD. We'll talk about that with my guest, Ernest Grant. He is now the president of the American Nurses Association. Talk about how he got involved, why his passion for nursing evolved, and how he got involved in burn care. All of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest is Ernest Grant, first male president of the American Nurses Association, spent decades specializing in burn care at the J.C. Burn Center at UNC School of Medicine. So we talked about this. You wanted to be a doctor. Guidance counselor says, we needed money. Be a nurse first, use the money, and then pay for med school. Good idea. 6 months into nursing school, you decide this is your passion. What was it?
I think it was just being able to realize that you can do more for your patients as a nurse. No offense to physician colleagues, but you're there 24/7. You come home feeling good about the work that you did that day, and I've used that philosophy throughout my whole 40 some years as being a nurse. I always ask myself at the end of the day, did I make a difference in someone's life? And 99% of the time, I can answer yes, and you get that good feeling about that.
Certainly doctors do, and you wouldn't say they don't, that doctors do make a difference in people's lives, and they do. They should go home most times feeling good at the end of a day. But there is a fundamental difference in the way you do your jobs, right? And so I sort of want to get to that. That point, that 24/7, I guess, that bedside care and how that differs from the sort of periodic care that a doctor would do.
Oh, absolutely. As I said, we're with the patient 24/7. We get to know them very well. We get to be, earn their trust. Actually, for the 17th year in a row, nursing has been rated as the number one trusted profession in the country. The mere fact that, someone who... obviously, if they've been hospitalized, they feel perhaps I've lost control. I don't have understanding of what's going on and et cetera. But then there's this one person who is constantly present there or that's representing this profession that is constantly present there and can put things at ease or can perhaps explain things to me a little bit more on my level that perhaps I wasn't able to understand when, someone else was speaking to me. And so you can empathize with the person. You can, after you get to know them for a while, when they're anxious, it could be something else that, that they're worried about. If it's a farmer, who's going to take care of my animals or get my crops in, or if it's, something else going on with their families not being able to visit perhaps until the weekend. Those are the ways that you, as a nurse, are able to, to interact with that individual and, get them to open up and to talk about their feelings and their concerns.
Yeah, and it's interesting just the way we structured medical care. I mean, for a doctor, they're, time is money. Mm-hmm. And if you think about what they're going to have to be much more concise in the amount and thoughtful about the amount of time they spend. Mm-hmm. And as you say, you're there 24/7. And there's a certain performative, this is subtle but interesting, isn't it, that there's a certain performative aspect to being a patient. Right, yeah. You put on a little. When the doctor comes, you kind of show off a little, don't you? And they have to cut through the performance. And when you're there and on the bedpan and taking the shower and every minute when you need a shave 2 days ago, you just drop that with the nurse and you get to know them a little better. And if you're a good nurse, you can pick up a lot of good stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And that's information you can refer to members of the healthcare team as well. And in saying, oh, by the way, did you know, this particular aspect about this person that could be very, contributing to their care that perhaps, other members may have missed. Or the person didn't open up, at that particular time.
You're hoping they're going to factor that in. If it didn't show up on a test, sometimes it doesn't make its way in, even though you've got the good reconnaissance. So now talk about your career, because you worked at Mission Health in Asheville for 5 years. Mm-hmm. You did become an LPN. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask you about this, because you were a male. That was unusual. Mm-hmm. You were African-American. Mm-hmm. What was it like to be sort of carry those unique features into this job?
Well, during that time, obviously, there were not that many males who were in nursing or going into nursing at that particular time. So the one thing I would say that I really had to essentially stand my ground and not be seen as a licensed orderly, if you will. And for those who may not understand that term, an orderly was a male nursing assistant who would do a lot of the menial tasks, such as help to lift patients or insert Foleys and things like that. But there was definitely a defined job description that they did. So to be a male nurse and to be on the floor with my female colleagues, one of the things I had to establish very quickly was that we went to the same nursing program. I am your equal. I don't mind helping you lift this patient or whatever, but what would you do if I wasn't here? How would you achieve that? And so to stand your ground and make sure that they understood that we're equal, that was quite a challenge, but eventually, was accepted and continued on from there.
And like it or not, it has become a gendered at that point, and perhaps still is a gendered profession and role. Did you face any, other sort of discrimination or difficulties as a male in this?
Oh, yes. Yes, you face that not only as a male, but, as you mentioned, being a minority as well. Obviously, racism, let's face it, it's there. Right. You just have to learn how to deal with that. That's one of the challenges of, choosing to go into a profession that involves helping people, is that you're going to meet people who have automatically stereotypes or prejudice against you because of who you are or the particular profession that you're in. A lot of times it was, oh, well, you became a nurse because you couldn't go to med school, or, sometimes they would still, even though you'd say I'm a nurse, they'd still call you doctor, and you have to, correct them and say, no, I'm a nurse, those type things. Mm-hmm. But generally, as far as with the prejudice part, I don't let that bother me, because I see that as their problem, not my problem. And my job is to try to help you through this particular situation that has brought you or brought us together. And I'm going to do the best that I can to achieve the best outcome that we can. And of course, if they choose otherwise, then we can try to make arrangements for if they would like someone else to care for them, and we try to do that.
Has that happened?
Once or twice, and it's not bad over my 40 years in nursing, but generally most people, as I said, when they come into the hospital, they're very vulnerable. They're they're having to let down their guard. So after they see that you are genuine and that you really are there to care for them, generally they open up and are very accepting of who you are.
Now, you moved to the Triangle in the early 1980s, became an RN. Mm-hmm. What made you move?
Well, I was during the time that I was at Mission Hospital, as you stated, I was an LPN, but I realized that I wanted to be able to do more for the patients that I care for. And the only way to do that was to become a registered nurse. At that time, the role of the LPN was very clearly defined. You were limited in your scope of practice. Mostly you were a medication nurse, or you did do patient care, but you could not do, you were not the charge nurse, or other things that that had been the identified role for the registered nurse. So I'd started taking courses towards my bachelor's degree and had moved to the Triangle to complete that. And I did that at North Carolina Central. And when I moved here to the Triangle, I was also at that time a member of the JCs, which is a civic organization. And when I moved here and was interviewing for jobs, there was a position open at the North Carolina J.C. Byrne Center. And I said to myself, well, why not work at a place where you have raised funds, to help the patients there. And my intent was to stay just for a year. And 36 years later, I retired from that job.
To be perfectly honest with you, I can think of many reasons why not stay at a Byrne Center. I would find that extraordinarily difficult work, and you love it. Why?
I love that work because it was very challenging. I realized that everything I learned in nursing school, and I literally do mean everything, I could apply on a daily setting. The fascinating thing about the Byrne Center is that we treated patients from the very young to the very old. In fact, the youngest patient I had was a week old. So you had to be very well versed in the care of those different populations and also realize that you're dealing with people who may also come in with other additional problems in addition to the fact that they've been burned. There's the psychosocial issues as well, a lot of cultural issues. You were challenged on a number of sides, and that's what made that job so really fascinating is that no one day or 2 days were the same. Every day was a different day. And again, that just reinforced my philosophy that I had when I would be leaving and say to myself, did I make a difference in someone's life today?
You're going to be with people for a long time. I mean, that's one of the features of this, that it doesn't, the treatment doesn't end quickly. What about that? I mean, staying with people who are in such distress for so long.
I think the benefit of that is that, again, as we've been talking about, you really get to know the person for who they are. We would have patients who would stay 3 months, 6 months. I think the longest was a patient who stayed for 2 years. So obviously you get to know those individuals and their family very, very well. And out of that, you also develop a lot of friendships. I have friends who I met as a result of their, having sustained a burn injury. And our friendship have lasted, 25, 30 years. We pick up the phone, call each other, and, they tell me, you're family. You're invited to, my daughter's weddings or, other events or special events that happen in their lives. I can't think of any better way to, to show your appreciation for, for that bond that we have than to, to be honored to be considered a member of their family.
And you mentioned the psychosocial part of it. I mean, in so many cases, people will get better to the extent that they can leave the hospital, but often they are changed forever in ways that make it very difficult for them to sort of reintegrate with family, with spouses and all of that. How much counseling do you end up doing with them and the family over these radical changes?
Quite a lot of counseling. Actually, that's one of the things that the Byrne Center recognized very early on. In the early 80s, people who sustained a burn would tend to become what we call reclusive. In other words, they'd be discharged, they stay home, they wouldn't get out in the public, for fear of people, looking at them, staring at them, perhaps making fun of them. And we have developed, our medical director saw the need for that and developed a very strong, what we call aftercare program. And part of that program is addressing those psychosocial issues. How to do, what to say, perhaps when people are looking at you or looking at your scars, how to dress to or apply makeup that perhaps does not make those scars as prominent. Couples, we have a couples weekend therapy. Because again, you not only have to talk about the psychosocial issue, you have to talk about the intimacy issues as well. Does my spouse still find me, sexually attractive, and things like that are some of the ways that we help our patients, cross those hurdles and realize that they have a new life, a new beginning, and sometimes to realize that I can still get that trust from the people that I just spent the last six months with. That's someone that can can help me through this.
You took all of this experience to New York in the aftermath of 9/11. Talk about that.
That came about as a result of when 9/11 happened. The staff at the Burn Center there at Cornell, I believe they thought that perhaps, you know, we're okay, we can handle this, you know, but you can only work so many double shifts, you know, without being tired and fatigued. And obviously, that's, studies have shown as that happens, there's the increase for mistakes and as well as nurse burnout. So there was a call that was sent from the American Burn Association asking for volunteers to come up to New York and work for a 2-week period. You rotate in for 2 weeks and work and then rotate out. And then, of course, if you wanted to volunteer for another 2-week stance, you could. So myself and two colleagues, Anita Fields and Mary Kessler, and I answered that call. That was very fascinating as well because, again, you're being you just had 1 day of orientation. We worked night shifts, which I hadn't worked nights in quite some time. But to be, you know, essentially just dropped into this hospital, which had totally different, you know, computerized charting system than we did. You know, their whole way of doing dressings were different than what we had. And of course, again, you still understood, though, that, you know, what your job was and, you know, the needs that was being asked of you. Out of that, I know my friend Anita, again, she developed friends with, you know, with some of the survivors from that as well. And one of them has written a book. But again, that, you know, that same camaraderie there, you know, continued and still very, very close friends with the nurses there that, you know, at the Burn Center there at Cornell, even today.
And you were honored for your work at the White House.
Yes. One of my mentors had written up a, you know, an experience or my experience, I should say, submitted that to Nursing Spectrum magazine. They had a contest for a National Nurse of the Year. And, you know, I wound up winning. And part of that was to you had a Oval Office visit with President Bush. And, you know, that was very humbling to, you know, to have the opportunity to meet President Bush. Although at the same time that was happening, we were having the explosion in the Kinston plant. So that
you
was
had to
very
go right home, right?
Yes. I had to tell him, well, thank you, sir. But now I have to drive back home and, you know, because I'm needed back at the Burn Center because of the explosion that happened in Kinston.
I think six people. That was 2003. There were 6 deaths and about 36 people injured.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That was terrible. And also the Hamlet fire,
yes.
Which was a horrific fire at a chicken processing plant, 25 people killed. Mm-hmm. The head of that company went to jail only for 4 years, although sentenced to 20 years for the catastrophic and abominable infractions, health and safety infractions that killed 25. What's that like working in that sort of disaster where a whole community really feels the pain of that?
In situations like that, you you know, you realize that this is when your expertise is really being called into play. When the Hamlet plant happened, I was in graduate school. I remember leaving my class at noon, turning on the radio, WUNC, as a matter of fact, and hearing about that. And without second thoughts, I just, you know, started driving right towards the you know, the hospital, and you know, putting on scrubs and, you know, joining the rest of the crowd there, you know, doing the best that you can. One of the things, you know, about that is that, again, you begin to realize that your expertise and what you have learned over the years with disasters and things, you're able to tell people what to expect or as you do disaster planning, you know, you can begin to plan for that, you know, mommy or daddy's not going to be able to come home today because, you know, there's been an emergency. You know, we've got to stay and, you know, help mitigate this, you know, this particular incident or whatever. So it really does, you know, in some ways put a toll on your family life. But your family understands that you're doing good for the community.
But in that case, too, in the Hamlet fire, the whole community was affected because so many people were working at that plant. The conditions were awful. The doors were chained. People weren't allowed to use phones. I mean, they, as I say, it's abominable to think about those working conditions. And it did at least get a prison sentence, although only 4 of 20 years served. But the whole community feels it. What is it like for you to move into a situation where you realize this is not a personal tragedy, bad as that might be, this whole community is aching over this.
Again, it goes back to, when I was growing up and that sense of community that, that is there. One of the things that begins to happen is, sometimes the community begins to develop a distrust of, what is going on. And so you have to, work with those people through the grieving process and also get them to understand that, you're doing the best that you can. But it's also they need to, hold community leaders accountable for, for various things or infractions, because everyone wants to live in a very safe community. And, it's important for citizens to be aware of, what is going on around them and not wait to react, but to be proactive and, and understand, that safety is the number one thing that you need to be aware of.
We're going to take a break right here and talk more about your efforts to help us understand how nurses can become more involved in just that, in developing trust and better connections and relationships with communities. When my conversation with Ernest Grant continues, he's the president of the American Nurses Association, and our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Ernest Grant, first male president of the American Nurses Association, worked for more than 3 decades at the North Carolina J.C. Burns Center at the UNC School of Medicine. The White House recognized him for his work in helping victims after 9/11. We talked about that. We talked about even earlier than that, in the 1990s, the Hamlet chicken processing fire that you also worked to help out in that disaster, and the Pope Air Base disaster, too. That was in 1994. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, the afternoon that the Pope Air Base disaster happened, I was charge nurse, and I remember picking up the phone, and there was this excited voice on the other end, saying, we've had a plane crash, we need beds. How many beds do you have? And I'm thinking, we're near Raleigh-Durham, so perhaps maybe a an airliner had gone down. And then subsequently we found out, that obviously it was an incident at Pope Air Base. The challenging thing about that was, this time all the other incidents had been civilian related. So when it's a military incident like that, obviously the military comes in, they take over, and you're having to, to follow their protocols and things of that sort. So it made things a little bit more challenging. But, everyone that was there that day and, people came out of the woodworks to help us to get patients settled. We even had former nurses, that had worked at the Burns Center, was still in the community, calling to come in and, and do whatever they could as well. So it was a great way to, to meet that challenge and to be prepared for that. The sad part about it was that you had all these very young men, 18, 19, 20 year olds who had exactly the same type injury that they were not going to survive, and that was
a very
tragic day.
And the reason that you had the numbers that you did was because it was a midair collision, and then some of the one of the planes crashed into a staging area with a lot of people on the ground.
And there was a big fireball, and and that's what what brought that in. But it was I was happy to be able to be there to to lend my knowledge that I had to help with that particular situation. One of the things that I so enjoy about being a nurse is that, as I said, you see people when they're at their most vulnerable, but you're also there with them during, as they begin to transition. And as a lot of these individuals were from other states, their families couldn't be with them. So to have the honor to be there, with those young men as they transitioned from this life to the next, was quite an honor as well.
You have taken your expertise abroad as well and run clinics and been part of programs in other countries. Mm-hmm. Talk about the other places that you've worked, because that also would give you a sense of how other people do medicine, and you should be able to compare a little bit of how our industry here in this country.
Yes, it does. I have had the pleasure of setting up some, big emphasis is on burn prevention, obviously. Right. We always had the philosophy at the Burn Center that the best way to treat a burn is to prevent it from occurring in the first place. Luckily, through my collegial relationships, I have gone to Moldova, the country of Moldova, which is a sister country to the North Carolina National Guard, to help them establish and or do some continuing education for them on burn care and burn prevention. Same thing in Ethiopia. We also set up and still have an ongoing burn prevention program in the country of South Africa as well. There it's quite a challenge because of the fires and things that happen. They happen in the shanty towns. So, and a lot of those shacks, they share a common wall. So when one shack catches a fire, it's just like a domino effect. And one of the things you have to do is go in and understand, you know, what it is about the community, you know, how do people live and things of this sort, that before you can begin to, you know, start applying, you know, American ideology, right. You need to, put it to their particular ideology. Same thing with healthcare as well. You begin to, you know, investigate and you have to realize that sometimes because of the resources that they have, burns that we can save here, say a 40% burn here could survive, but a 40% burn in some of those foreign countries, they do not survive because of the lack of resources that they may have.
Certainly there's things an American can teach abroad in terms of technology and with our resources, mm-hmm. but it seems to me we might also learn some things from those countries. What have you learned about how medical care could be delivered in this country a little bit?
Oh, there's lots of things. One is one of the things that I know in each of those countries is that people tend to listen to the patient more, try to get an understanding of who this person is, what was their, what was their life like, what was their role in the community, and et cetera, to, try to, really and truly understand that individual. Also, you begin to see that people are eager for whatever healthcare resources or things that you may be able to bring to them, and of course, we learn from them as well. And again, it's more of a cultural exchange type thing, but you really are, you have to realize that you don't come in with all the answers. You need to understand their culture, who they are, and then together, set up a plan of, how we're going to go about, achieving our outcomes.
So you wanted to be, we said you're president of the American Nurses Association, and that's something you really wanted to do. Mm-hmm. Why? What are your goals for this?
Ever since I became a registered nurse, that was, if you had a conversation with anyone who knew me, they would probably say, oh, yes, he wants to be president of the ANA. I just didn't realize that I would be the first male president. But I do have, when I ran on essentially four goals. One was to increase the diversity of nursing, recognizing that America is a melting pot. And if you are from another ethnicity and all you see are people who do not look like you, you're probably apprehensive. You probably are not going to be very open and forthcoming with members of the healthcare team, or at least right away. But you are put at ease when you see someone that that looks like you, that is from your own culture, that you can put even more trust in. It's a great way to to have that blending and to establish that trust. The other component was to increase our relationship with the consumer. Let people know that nurses are everywhere. We're not just in the hospital. And of course, as healthcare is moving from the hospital setting out in the community, it's more vitally important that they understand that we are in the community and that we are there to advocate on their behalf.
Why is that important?
Well, it's important because, there's this thing that we call the social determinants of health, where we have identified about 17 or 18, different topics that, will determine, how healthy a person may be, something like poverty or clean water or food or things of this sort. So the same thing that, nurses are able to address We talk about prevention. Well, if we can help to minimize those things, then obviously that means you're going to have a healthier individual, which means that perhaps instead of waiting to treat that stroke or whatever that may have happened, if you could have prevented that years ago by promoting a healthy lifestyle, getting rid of those food deserts and, you know, things like this, educating the public, we would all be more beneficial as a result of that. So nurses are able to help to, begin to drive that change, if you will.
The social determinants of health are interesting in that many of them are personal. They're lifestyle decisions that we make and therefore things we can change. Mm-hmm. And many of them are well outside of our control. You talk about food deserts and poverty and all of those things where people find it very difficult to get themselves out of those situations. To what extent would nurses, or should they, do you think, apply themselves to being agents of change?
Well, definitely. Again, as I stated, we have the trust of the public for one, but the mere fact that we are in the community and try to get people to see that, as a community, we need to invest in ourselves. And by working together, we can perhaps have better outcomes. And, going to those who are in positions of authority and, insisting that they, do whatever they can to help, improve the life in the community. So it's not.
Does this mean organizing nurses?
Well, it's not necessarily organizing nurses, but it is. It's more or less, nurses letting people know the resources that are out there, or educating them to the resources that are out there, and working with them, not necessarily, leading them, but working with them to promote a better lifestyle.
And these things are, it seems to me, very closely related. Your two top priorities: number one, the greater diversity, mm-hmm. and then two, becoming a greater awareness of these social determinants mm-hmm. and applying yourselves to them. Because it seems to me that one of the good things about identifying social determinants for health is that we know better and mm-hmm. we can do something about it. The downside might be that you end up blaming the victim all over again. You're poor and it's your fault. Mm-hmm. Get yourself out of there and then you'll feel better. And of course, you can't just do that. But here's where diversity, it seems to me, and I'd like to hear your take mm-hmm. on this, where it really matters that having somebody being able to coach you through that who may have a better mm-hmm. Understanding of your own social and cultural situation might be in a better place to help you work through some of these things.
Absolutely. And we're able to, to intercede, if you will, and to share, with our healthcare colleagues about, in this culture, things are addressed this way or that way. You can't just, come right in and, perhaps be dictatorial. You really need to understand where that person is coming from, from a cultural perspective, or even just an individual, their own individual self, where they may be coming from. And that way you're able to provide the best care that you can for that particular individual. We're one of the big things now in healthcare is sort of designer medicine. But I think, 40, 50 years ago, they had that right, when people would actually take the time to listen mm-hmm. to the individual and what they had to say and not, perhaps make rash decisions right away. But if you really take the time to listen and understand, you're going to get a more cooperative patient and you also have better outcomes.
I can't wait to do this. We don't usually take calls, but here's someone who's called in and said, Ernest is still, and this is all in caps, so this must have been what the producer heard, still the best nurse I have ever observed. Ultimately, knowledgeable, kind, compassionate, helpful without demeaning me. I remain in awe of him, a paragon of nursing. I'm 77 years old. I am a 77-year-old nurse, still working part-time. It's a calling and an art, as well as a giving, and he possesses endless calm and energy. Thank you, Susan.
Well, thank you.
I just thought I'd pass that on. Thanks. Tell me more about, to that point and to the discussion that we've just had, because it seems to me we have an industry that's not well designed to deliver the kind of care that you've described, mm-hmm. taking time to listen, if you talk to nurses today, and I bet you do, mm-hmm. I bet you hear how they're cracking the whip, get those meds passed, because you've mm-hmm. got 30 more to do, mm-hmm. and we're not going to put any more mm-hmm. nurses on. Mm-hmm. We have inexplicably the most expensive health care in the world, and we don't have the outcomes to show for it. What's going on here, and are there ways that systemically we could move things around to allow for the kind of care that you describe?
Yes, there are. One of the things that we're doing at ANA is when we're looking at healthcare legislation that may be proposed, either at the national level, the local level, you know, the state level, and et cetera. Well, let me back up for just a second. One of the things that I try to do is to get nurses to be more to be advocates from a legislative perspective. They need to understand that decisions that are made in Washington or here in Raleigh or at the local level is somehow or other going to affect their ability to practice to, you know, to the best of their ability. And it may be that there is a law that comes that says you can no longer do this or you can't do this, or it's going to affect the individual being able to have access to health care. Still, it is still going to be able to affect their ability to practice. So I strongly advocate that nurses become aware of that and that they begin to attend town hall meetings and talk to the politicians when they're asking that, and not necessarily challenge them, but just say, do you realize when you make this decision, it may look good on paper, but here's how it's affecting people in my community or people in your community, and perhaps there's a better way that we can perhaps address this particular issue rather than just blanketly saying, one thing is going to be able to fit everything.
Well, apparently in Washington State, that's a place where you should start. There's a Republican state senator there who made a public remark. They were trying to pass more humane laws and address this issue, and the legislature took it on and said, we've just got to allow more time. Mm-hmm. We're going to allow breaks and make sure that they don't railroad these nurses the way they're being pushed. So they put some legislation in to protect nurses, which ultimately makes for better health care. Mm-hmm. And this Republican state senator said that those nurses are probably playing cards a considerable amount of the day anyway, she said.
Yes. And, well,
you got to reckon with
she,
stuff
she
like
has
that.
Lived to regret those words. I personally wrote a comment to her as president of ANA, but her office reports literally hundreds of thousands of emails, not only from nurses, but from other members of the healthcare team and the public in general, stating that that was a not a good thing to say about the most trusted profession. And one of the things, what I meant to have said earlier, so at ANA, we have four, when healthcare legislation is being considered, there are four things that we sort of weigh that against. One, anything that will impede access to care, then we're not for that. Anything that, obviously we want to try to do things that will help lower healthcare costs, but we also want quality healthcare. And then the most important is that there is enough workforce. We're facing a nursing shortage now, and it's expected to get even greater. And so we need to get more people interested in the profession. And one of the ways to start doing that is going into the elementary schools now, not just high schools, but it needs to start at an early age, getting kids interested in science and realizing that nursing is a profession. It is not a trade as it was portrayed before. We have evidence-based research that we can base our practice on, and continues to elevate the profession.
Ernest Grant is doing just that as the president of the American Nurses Association. As a matter of fact, turns out to be the first male president of that association. And you can find out more about him and our show at our website, stateofthings.org. Ernest Grant, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.